Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Al Nofi, military historian and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. So Jim and Al, we've talked a lot about Afghanistan over the last few months, and we all know what's happening there now, but it'd be interesting to know what the historic perspective is on Afghanistan. Al, how long has this been going on?
Well, in some ways, the culture that exists there, the essentially a tribal environment with a small number of cities, has been a phenomenon since the earliest recorded evidence coming from Afghanistan, which I guess but goes back to the Persians, and they control the area primarily indirectly. They come in with a huge army, and so the local tribes, of course, would maybe put up some resistance but realize this was stupid. But the Persians would always cut deals with the local warlords, as long as the taxes were forwarded, and they didn't really mind what was going on too much. The Macedonians, when Alexander the Great came in, pretty much did the same thing, because he showed up with this huge army, and no tribe could match the army, And since rules of engagement were very simple, you just killed everybody, it was good to make peace. So they made peace, and then, there was a kingdom in there.
The reason Alexander showed up was because he wanted to go through the Khyber Pass, correct?
The other reason is that for most of its, the recorded history, what we know of as Afghanistan, at least most of it, was part of the Persian Empire. And the reason it was part of the Persian Empire was until about 500 years ago, there was an economic reason for controlling Afghanistan. That's because it was part of the Silk Route. So if you wanted to control the commerce to China, Afghanistan was a essential link in that, chain of trading posts and oases and what have you, that brought the goodies, the luxury goods basically, back and forth. But, Afghanistan as we know it arrived when the Europeans, discovered how to sail to the China instead of going overland. And at that point, the Persians basically pulled out. The only thing they really left behind was Dari, a Persian dialect, which is widely used as a lingua franca in the area. Other than that, as Al points out, the only thing the area was good for was the entry to India, to the Khyber Pass. And there's another one to the north that is no longer used because they didn't build a good road through it. There's only so many ways you can get into India. The southern route is not very good because it's all desert. Marching through a desert is not a good idea. If you remember your ancient Greek history, that's what Alexander did coming back, and it didn't work out too well. But if you want to go in there, you will want to go through well-watered areas, with forage for your horses and animals, and that's the Khyber Pass route, and that's where the mass invasions of India have come through for thousands of years.
Yeah, and there's no local product that anybody particularly wants, except I guess Afghans who make good warriors, and the country of course has. After the Mongols moved in, it was from the Central Asia, including Afghanistan, that they invaded India.
But it's funny. The Indians refer when they name the various invasions, from that direction. Mm-hmm. They often call them Afghan invasions, even though the Afghans were only part of the, the mighty host that, came through the pass.
So now, before the Mongols, though, Al, we have Islam moving into the area. Now, was that military or was that just a cultural invasion of the area?
Well, it was a little of both. Well, probably the very first wave of Islamic expansion was primarily motivated by religious drive. After a while, it got to be profit as well. And so, you move in. I think it was in the mid 8th century that Islam got into the middle of Central Asia, defeated the Chinese in a huge battle on the Taras River, about which virtually nothing is known except that the Arabs won, and ejected the Chinese from there. And, of course, that was still the issue of profit, because they didn't get much further than that. But now they controlled completely the Silk Route, and what was it, something like a pound of gold for every pound of silk? That was the going price in like the Mediterranean world.
Yeah, it was expensive going overland. That's why the European invention of ships that could go around South Africa and make it all the way, or if you're somebody like Magellan, go around South America and go straight to China. It's a lot cheaper to do it by boat, even though it takes a long time. It took it must have taken over a year to a couple of years to walk basically from China to the Middle East.
Yeah, when you read Marco Polo stuff, it takes forever for them to get there.
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like Marco Polo, talks about this village and that village, and that, I mean, it's like, my God, just an incredible trek. So silk was one of the few products that you could actually move, and of course gold.
Well, that was the big problem. The Chinese didn't really want any luxury goods from the West except silver or precious metals, and that caused all sorts of financial, much like the oil trade these days, it caused all sorts of financial problems in the West. But that's all ancient history. The basic problem with Afghanistan today is that it's all these Indo-Aryan tribes. These are basically the distant ancestors of the Europeans who decided to stay put. There's the Pashtuns and the Tajiks and many smaller groups. And they just sit up there in the mountains, in those valleys. Some of them are pastoral in the drier areas, and they fight each other. And it's basically the poorest part of Asia, the shortest lifespans. It's just, the armpit of Eurasia. Nobody really wanted to get mixed up with the area because there's no there, and the people aren't too hospitable. But wouldn't you know it, international terrorists decide to set up shop and you haven't got much choice. So we're basically stuck there. Everybody's looking for a solution. And historically, well, there is only one solution. You go in there and you kill everybody in sight until the survivors settle down. And, apply as needed, decade after decade. You can't do that anymore. And most Afghans, if you gave them a choice, they'd immigrate. So you've really got a very bad situation.
Right. Now, how long has the opium trade been going on there?
Only a couple of decades. The opium trade used to be the heroin trade.
Yeah.
It's wandered around over the centuries. Heroin, of course, was only invented about a century or so ago by a chemical process you applied to opium. And, of course, opium's been around for much longer than that.
And, of course, it was an early attempt to get people off illegal drugs.
Yeah. be careful what you ask for. For a long time, the center of the heroin trade was on the Chinese-Burmese border. Where Chiang Kai-shek's defeated divisions, set up camp to get away from the communists. That was cleared out about 30 years ago. The Chinese and the Burmese finally got together. And it ended up in Pakistan. That lasted for about a decade. The Pakistanis basically had the same problem everybody has when the drug business moves in. Warlords and addiction. Even in a poor country like Pakistan, basically they could afford to buy cheap opium that was manufactured right there, and you had millions of addicts. It was a huge problem, and it was so bad that they even convinced the tribes, who have their own laws up there on the border area, to cooperate in expelling the trade. But it just went right across the border. And the Pakistanis, Pashtuns, are still very active in the smuggling of the stuff out. That accounts for a lot of the income. About 40% of the heroin in Afghanistan is now smuggled out via Pakistan. About an equal amount goes out through Iran, where it's a huge problem. They have 2 or 3 million addicts in Iran. And the rest of it goes out through Central Asia. But it moved into Afghanistan, and it's basically been a major factor in the disorder in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, for over 20 years. A lot of the warlords during the Civil War in the 90s were basically drug lords, simply trying to protect their very lucrative business. And the Taliban came in; they didn't get rid of it. That's another big myth. They went through the pretense of shutting it down for 1 year simply because there was an overabundance of it, and they had inventory problems. So they said, hey, let's kill two birds with one stone. You know, we officially, you know, stop it. And they basically stopped growing and brought reporters in to show them, see, these fields are now growing wheat. See, they used to grow, you know, poppies.
Was a political thing, because what they did,
they wanted foreign aid.
But also they made sure that the tribes that didn't support the Taliban were definitely out of the drug business.
Yes, and that's why it all ended up down by Kandahar, because that's where the most pro-Taliban tribes are. So basically, I think you have something like 60-70% of the world supply of heroin coming from Helmand Province, which is right outside of Kandahar. And in fact, most of the heroin in Afghanistan, something like 80% of it, is grown in the by the Pushtun tribes, the pro-Taliban Pushtun tribes in southern Afghanistan. So what's going on in Afghanistan is really not a war against the Taliban, because they haven't got much money. They haven't got that much clout. They're just a bunch of religious fanatics who, we forget what happened in 2001 was we didn't defeat the Taliban. The Taliban were still fighting a civil war with the non-Pushtun tribes in the north, and when the CIA and Special Forces guys parachuted in with those suitcases full of $100 bills, you know, people were willing to turn real cheap. It didn't take a whole lot of pressuring to get a lot of the Pushtun tribes to turn on the Taliban, because it had already been happening. And so the situation hasn't changed much. The tribes look out for themselves, which is how the only way you survive in that area, because there's never been any central government worth anything in that part of the world. So most Afghans, you know, you talk to them about what government can do for you, and they have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. Now, we sort of skipped over the Brits. The Brits
were the Republicans, I guess. But anyway, go ahead.
Right. We sort of skipped over the Brits. Now, the Brits tried to push in there during the 19th century, but had little or no success, correct?
Well, the British learned real quick. They you know, some of the best disaster stories of the British Empire still occur in Afghanistan. What they figured out real quick, and they'd done this before, was they realized it's not worth it. It's expensive. You know, the British Raj was basically a business operation. And they basically cast about and bought off the nastiest tribal chieftain, whoever he was at the time. I think that the first time they did it was a guy named Abdullah the Insane or something like that. And they told him, look, we'll give you guns and money. Just keep the Afghans out of the lowlands. Keep them on your side of the Khyber Pass, and we'll make you rich. And that worked pretty well, as it usually does.
And keep the Russians out.
Right.
Well, yeah, but that didn't require too much problem, because the Russian Tsar quickly learned that if he was having trouble with one of his courtiers, he just appointed him ambassador to Afghanistan. That was usually a one-way trip.
Yeah.
There are many ways to die in Kabul.
Why did the Soviets in 1980 decide to go into Afghanistan?
They were dragged in. They had been.
But it was also that it was a political decision.
Yeah, it was the Communist Party of Afghanistan.
Yeah, but the Soviet military leadership said this was a bad idea.
Oh yes, the famous general staff briefing.
Yeah. I mean, they said no, this is not going to work.
Logistically, it doesn't work. But Brezhnev was studying tactics, not logistics.
Yeah,
there was. It was political. Basically, they didn't want to lose face. They had supported the Afghan Communist Party, which was very active in the cities, particularly Kabul. You know, an old story. But these guys, these urban Afghans, were pretty much disconnected with the country folk. For one thing, you didn't go into the country unless it was countryside, unless it was your own tribe, because, you know, banditry was and still is a very popular outdoor sport in the warmer weather. And it was simply dangerous, so you stayed in the city. He didn't travel much. And these guys were literally out of touch with what was going out in the countryside. And what was going on out in the countryside was they were hearing about this stuff in the cities, where in Kabul, where you had the king of Afghanistan. Now, the king had one function, one primary function, to deal with outsiders and keep them out. The only thing that King did internally was occasionally he would basically preside over a jirga, you know, a tribal gathering of the tribal elders to try and arbitrate, but he had no power.
Yeah, well, and you think of him as the honorary don.
Yeah, exactly. He was a godfather without portfolio.
Yeah. And jirga is the meeting of the godfathers.
Exactly, the real power. And he would simply, you know, sit at the head of the table and, you know, point to whoever raised their hand and say, all right, you know, so-and-so speaks. I mean, he had no power. The communists there was a coup, a cousin of the king, the one who came back after 2001 and then died a few years ago. He staged a coup, and then he was in turn overthrown by the communists. Now, this was very bad because, A, you know, it was a family affair, and now all of a sudden you've got these political godless heathens, you know, running the country. And then they fell to fighting among themselves. At this point, the Russians said, oh my God, we finally got a communist government in this hellhole, and now they're fighting amongst themselves in a typical Afghan fashion. So they decided they'd have a surgical operation. They'd send Spetsnaz commandos, they'd kill off the weaker factions, put the stronger faction in charge, and then leave. And at that point, the general staff, as Al pointed out, made their famous, you know, warning, you know, a great empire was going to fall, so to speak, thing. And the rest is history. The basic problem was the Russians, the logistics were not there to support more than about 150,000 troops in Afghanistan, because there's no railroads. There's no water transport. Everything has to come in over truck, by truck. And the general staff basically said, there's a limit to how many people we can put in there, and the number of people we can put in there is not enough to control the number of tribesmen that are out there. Now, the Russians knew this. They had a lot of history, and the Russians are very, very exacting when it comes to recording their past experience. I mean, I've seen the documents. They had fought for a century in Central Asia, but not in the mountains, out on the plains. They knew how to fight there. They knew what they were up against. But the population is denser in Afghanistan because you've got all these valleys. You got somewhat better weather. But you've got a logistics nightmare. And while they put railroads into their Central Asian areas and they had some rivers they could work with, there's nothing in Afghanistan. So the general staff was, you know, they're tearing their hair out saying, look, this is not going to work. And actually, it did. You know, let's dispense another myth. The Russians were not defeated in Afghanistan. They just got tired of paying for victory. They controlled most of the country. They bought off a lot of the warlords. They could go anywhere at will and kill, you know, whatever, as many Afghans as they wanted. But because the Saudis and us, the United States, it was mainly Saudi money that was buying all the weapons that the Afghans were doing, and the Russians could not afford to try and go into Pakistan because we were basically extending our nuclear umbrella over Pakistan, they had this Vietnam situation, and Vietnam was very fresh in everybody's minds, and they knew very well that, you know, Vietnam, as long as there's a sanctuary, it's an impossible situation. If you've got fanatics, in this case, you know, instead of communist fanatics, you got religious fanatics. If they're going to keep coming and coming and coming, well, yeah, you can keep killing them, but they're breeding in the refugee camps in Pakistan and in Iran. Do you want to keep this up? Is it worth it? And, you know, after the general staff marched into Brezhnev's office, well, Brezhnev died after a while, the accountants came in and said, look, you know, this is costing us so many billion rubles a year, and for what? A lot of some dead Russians, they only lost 15,000 dead throughout all this. By Russian standards, that's nothing. But they said, look, this is costing us a lot of money and it's getting us nothing. So they just declared victory and left. And of course, the guy they left behind, he lasted for another 5 years. And basically, he collapsed after the Soviet Union collapsed, and they withdrew this money and weapons they were sending him. So it was not a Soviet defeat. It just wasn't worth the price of victory. And that's always been the problem with Afghanistan. Can you afford to win and keep winning?
Right. And that's going to be the same problem that the us and the European countries have is, you know, I guess until we get Osama, people are going to be willing to stay there. But once he's actually been taken out, then everybody's going to pull out again.
Well, the big problem is, as long as you have international terrorists on either side of the border, either in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, we have an interest there. Because as long as these clowns can, you know, have their training camps and truck on down to, you know, Islamabad or whatever, Karachi, and jump on an airplane for Europe or North America, we have to do something about it. In other words, we cannot ignore it. The Russians could walk away because there was no Islamic terrorism directed at Russia at that point. There was nothing. But as long as we have the terrorism, but yeah, you're right. The minute the terrorism is no longer a problem, you know, there's going to be a real jam up at the exits because everybody's going to be rushing for them at once. There's no reason to stay there. Even the Afghans don't like staying there.
Yeah. Right. Of course, the mistake we made when the Russians left was we immediately dropped all our aid, which might have helped stabilize, you know, the economy.
Yeah, that's true. We'll never know. And people conveniently forget that. When the Russians left, Congress, which was run by the Democrats, was in no mood to throw any more money at, you know, at this war in Afghanistan. And that was by unanimous acclaim. There were very few people. You know, Charlie Wilson, you know, they made a movie about him, but that's all he got. There were very few people, and I was, you know, Al and I, we were all there reading the newspapers and what have you. I was writing books about it. Nobody, hardly anybody, was interested in doing anything in Afghanistan because even back then they knew the place is a hellhole. It's a tar baby. The more you hit it, the more you get stuck. So everybody rushed for the exits.
Al, we'll give you the last word on Afghanistan.
Well, the Petraeus' idea that you might be able to bring the tribes over probably has some merit. What we're going to end up with is our best case, of course, would be the so-called functioning democracy and so on. But that ain't going to happen. But we might get a kind of tribal federation again, which is the only thing that has ever given Afghanistan any stability. The last king there, what was his name? Something. No, he just died at the age of 99 or something. Actually managed to play the tribes against each other pretty well, and everybody had their nice piece of the pie, and so the country had about 40 years of stability from, I don't know, 1930 to, what was it, the coup was in 73, 74?
79. Oh, no, that's the coup that drew out the king. Yeah, that was in 73 or 74.
The king, yeah. And the coup only occurred because it was like a family quarrel.
His cousin, yeah.
Whoever it was wanted to take power, and that began the breakdown of the tribal federation, in effect. That only began to be restored a little bit when we went in 2001, 2002, but then we didn't keep up the pressure and the attention, and so the Taliban was able to regroup. But that's the best we can hope for. They're not going to be as democratic as anybody. they're going to have this federal arrangement of tribes and a little internal chaos. And forget about human rights because there aren't going to be very many of them. And they'll go along in their own sweet time. Even most of the tribes support education for girls now. So, maybe another 100 years they'll even support voting rights for girls, you know, and we'll see how that works out.
So things after the terrorists are gone will continue as they have for thousands of years.
Well, you still have the heroin problem.
Okay.
Take Colombia and Central Asia.
Okay. So we'll have that new factor there.
Right. Don't write off Afghanistan as a news story anytime soon. It'll always be a problem in Afghanistan that, thanks to the wonders of satellite communications and cheap air flights, whatever is going bad in Afghanistan will end up in our own backyard.
Well, I think that's a good place to end, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time.
Okay.
Till then, bye-bye.
Bye.
Have a good day.
Bye.